welcome back to the now weekly episode of the Complexity Premier podcast. We're experimenting with these weekly episodes for as long as the content remains interesting and rich for you, the listeners. Naturally, I'm joined by my co-host, Ying Yan Cheng. Ying is a portfolio management director at Coolabah Capital, where I'm also a portfolio manager. And for those who don't know, Coolabah runs over $10 billion in global fixed income strategies. So Ying, today we'll talk about two key things. The first is why we think central bank independence may be dead and how politicians are compromising central banks' commitments to their price stability targets, and why the ensuing sticky inflation will require a much tougher cost of capital to extinguish. And the second topic, Ying, is that we'll quickly cover is our April performance. Obviously, April was an incredibly tough month for equities and for fixed rate bonds, although floating rate strategies did well. So Ying, is in the last week, we've been presented with evidence that demonstrably suggests the US Federal Reserve is politically compromised. And furthermore, we suspect that it's entirely plausible that the RBA, that is the Reserve Bank of Australia, suffers from similar problems. Now, this shouldn't come as a surprise. Central banks subjugating their inflation targets to political imperatives was always going to be the biggest asset pricing risk as we experienced the first bona fide inflation crisis since the 1980s. And if you think that sounds hyperbolic, it's certainly the assessment of senior US bank bond traders and considered a credible case amongst some of the world's most successful hedge fund bosses. One senior US bank bond trader recently advised clients in writing, and apologies in advance for this accent, if we weren't in an election year, we would still very much be in a hiking cycle. Facing a direct existential threat to his leadership from former President Donald Trump, the Fed's chair, Jay Powell, clearly wants to do everything he can to avoid adversely impacting President Joe Biden's electoral prospects.
Chris, was that meant to be a New York accent?
No, actually, it was a Texan accent in deference to my hero, Patrick Mahomes, who is, of course, the three-time winning Super Bowl champion quarterback at the Kansas City Chiefs.
Okay, I think you might need to work on that a little bit. But anyway, look, as you know, Chris, last week was really a litmus test for Powell's loyalty to price stability. And rather than appropriately ruling out near-term cuts and warning that rates could climb as they should if the data continues to deteriorate, Powell triggered yet another rally in equities and bonds by dismissing the possibility of tightening policy and signaling that he thought the next move was likely down, albeit on a deferred basis. Frankly, Chris, it's pathetic. This is despite significant and repeated upside surprises to US inflation and wages data, which have blown the Fed's dovish forecasts out of the water. Of course, Powell has no idea where rates are heading, and he knows it. He just doesn't want to concede to this point for fear of the market pricing in some probability of, heaven forbid, rate rises, which would completely undermine Biden's popularity.
Don't disagree, Yingers. And speaking to one multi-billionaire macro trader recently, he commented that, quote, if Powell could cut rates to help Biden, he would. The RBA is in a similar bind, Yingers. There is simply no basis for its globally low and unnecessarily stimulatory 4.35% cash rate right now, underscored by the fact that its own macro models are telling it that the cash rate should be at 5%, given the RBA's estimate of neutral is 3.8%. That, of course, is just 0.55% or a bee's appendage below the current cash rate. While policy is not remotely restrictive according to the RBA's own analysis, which is why trim mean inflation has galloped ahead at a 4.1% annualized pace in the March quarter, which is, of course, nowhere near the RBA's 2.5% inflation target, Martin Place is nonetheless paralyzed by the fear of offending its political masters by pushing unemployment up from its historically skinny 3.8% base.
And Chris, our listeners would recall that it was the Fed's dovish pivot last year in response to a sharp yet transitory slump in goods prices as supply chains reopened that temporarily lowered estimates of core inflation, which created expectations that rates could be slashed. And not just in the US, but all around the world, we saw the RBA domestically blindly follow the Fed, making a similarly silly pivot. This forced 10-year government bond yields down from 5% in October 2023 to 3.8% in January, which precipitated huge appreciation in the price of stocks, bonds, property, and other correlated assets like crypto.
Yet, Ying's many months of data have highlighted an aggressive re-acceleration in annualized core inflation in the US from circa 2% to more than 3.5%. And that's using the Fed's preferred PCE measure, which has been driven by a dramatic increase in core services inflation as opposed to core goods inflation, where core services inflation is running at an incredibly elevated 5% on the Fed's preferred PCE measure, or 6.5% if we use the alternative CPI measure. When the Fed was hitting its 2% inflation target prior to the pandemic, core services inflation was bobbing around the 2% mark. Again, that's using the PCE measure. It was bobbing around 3% on the CPI measure. Price of services is surging on the back of strong US wage growth, which re-accelerated to 1.2% over the March quarter based on the Fed's preferred employment cost index, or the ECI. This was notably much higher than the consensus forecast of 0.9% growth in the March quarter. In fact, none of the 48 forecasters surveyed by Bloomberg predicted wage growth above 1.1% in the quarter. Productivity adjusted wage growth was also much faster than forecasters anticipated in the March quarter, printing at 4.7% annualized relative to the consensus guess of 3%. Now, Yingers, there's also speculation that these productivity adjusted wage numbers are in practice actually much higher. And that's because some folks believe the official data is not capturing illegal immigration flows into the US.
Yeah, and Chris, look, Australia confronts an even more precarious position. Productivity adjusted wages are pulsing at an astonishingly high 6.6% annual rate on our numbers, making it impossible for the RBA to deliver price stability. This is being driven by a labour market that is too tight precisely because we haven't yet had that hard landing. The US jobless rate of 3.8% remains conspicuously below the Fed's estimate of full employment, which requires unemployment to sit between 4 and 5%. And Australia's numbers are near identical in this respect. And Chris, I think it's really important to note that, contrary to popular myth, rate increases here in Australia have broadly the same effect on inflation as they do in the US, even accounting for the proliferation of our variable rate home loans.
Yingis, that's actually a really important point. I'm often asked whether the RBA doesn't need to lift rates as far as the Fed or the RBNZ or the Bank of Canada or the Bank of England, because ordinarily 85% of home loans in Australia are variable rate, whereas most home loans in the US work on a 30-year fixed rate basis. The idea is that rate hikes here hit much harder than hikes in the US, for example. But it's really interesting. When central banks, including the RBA, assess the impact of rate changes on the broader macroeconomy and the ultimate influence on inflation, they find that 100 basis points of rate increases here in Australia have an almost identical impact on inflation as 100 basis points of rate increases in Europe through the ECB or in the US via the Fed. And that's because monetary policy doesn't just work through the household channel. It works through the exchange rate. And of course, Australia's exchange rate is very low and therefore quite stimulatory, suggesting rates aren't high enough. It works through asset prices. And obviously, we've seen Aussie house prices rebound after their second biggest fall in 40 years over 22, 23, where they declined by 10% peak to trough, or 15% inflation adjusted, but have since recovered all those losses. And policy also works through the business sector. So you really need to model the agglomeration of those vectors to truly understand the general equilibrium effects of policy. And we do this research as well, and we've come to precisely the same conclusion. Right now, Yingers, a further concern is that this is all a globally synchronized phenomenon. We are seeing well above trend services inflation expanding at a 5 to 7% annual pace in Australia, Britain, Europe, New Zealand, and the US, which is powering unacceptably high core inflation, even though goods price deflation in countries like the US and in Europe, or goods price disinflation in Australia and New Zealand, which means that whilst goods prices are still increasing, they're rising at a slower pace, is for the time being artificially dragging down the overall inflation numbers as supply chains normalize. So if that's not clear, we have this dichotomy between goods prices that are either falling outright or rising at a decelerating pace, and rampant services inflation. And the services inflation of late has been compelling a re-acceleration in the overall inflation numbers, but the data would be a lot worse were goods prices to stabilize, which eventually they will. In Europe, for example, Coulibas' estimate of the trend in core inflation is now growing at an annual monthly rate of 3.5%, which has jumped up from a low of about 1.5% in November last year. Despite the fact that European goods prices are actually declining outright, bouncing overall. Inflation has been propelled by a rebound in services inflation, which has accelerated to about 5% from 1.75% late last year. While the ECB is hoping to cut interest rates soon, euro area unemployment remains at a multi-decade low of just 6.5%. What makes the emerging non-independence of central banks so depressing, I think, Yingers, is that it is occurring at a time when we've yet to really endure any serious economic pain. For all the talk of soft landings, which has been the dominant intellectual narrative for the best part of 6 to 12 months now, there has been no landing at all. Inflation is running miles above central banks' mandated targets. This cycle is not, therefore, Yingers, over.
And Chris, as we have often discussed, if we want to know what the future potentially looks like for Australia, we should cast our eyes towards New Zealand. Because if you look at New Zealand, it's currently in recession because its central bank has had no hesitation in lifting its cash rate to a lofty 5.5%. Unemployment has jumped from 3.2% to 4.3%. GDP has contracted almost continuously for more than 12 months, and wages growth is now decelerating. For now, inflation remains unacceptably high, but there is hope that the RBNZ can start cutting rates before the end of the year, which is not really a realistic expectation for its complacent Antipodean sibling, the RBA, unfortunately.
Is we've recently harnessed a Fed approach to modeling the persistence inflation, which we'll publish shortly, to understand how protracted or elongated this inflation crisis is likely to be. This will be a short, wonky digression, but this particular model is a parsimonious autoregressive framework, which really means it focuses on past inflation results to predict future outcomes over the next 3 years. And our application of this Fed model suggests that US inflation dynamics are yet to return to their pre-pandemic experience. It highlights that while goods inflation in the US has indeed been reverted back to its pre-pandemic path, core services inflation will likely remain too high. More specifically, the Fed model's three-year ahead forecast for overall core consumer price pressures and goods and services inflation in particular are incompatible with the Fed hitting its 2% target. Interestingly, Yingers, when we test this model's inflation forecasts against the collective wisdom of US economist predictions, the model beats economist forecasts about 60% of the time.
And Chris, central bank complacency is even more bewildering, given that in 2022 and 23, they repeatedly warned us about the risk of not acting robustly to stamp out the inflation crisis at the time.
That's right, Yingers, and sorry to jump in, but they did caution us that if rates were not lifted to high enough levels, we would face stubbornly sticky inflation that would require a much tougher cost of capital to extinguish. Even after we account for the typical 1 to 2 year lag associated with the application of monetary policy changes, that is rate hikes, this is exactly the situation we're left to grapple with today, Yingers. And unfortunately, it will be exacerbated if the central banks don't do something about it. If they did that as they're doing right now, this inflation crisis is going to be much harder to stamp out. We're almost in the middle of 2024, and we knew this was a crisis way back in 2021. And of course, they started hiking rates in late 2021 or early to mid 2022. So the current nascent wage price spiral that we're observing through the nexus between services inflation and labor cost growth is just not acceptable. Now, Yingers, I'm cognizant of the fact that many of our listeners are also investors, so I want to quickly provide a performance update for the month of April. Returns across Coolabah strategies were very solid. Starting with our A-plus rated daily liquidity floating rate high yield fund, it returned 1.12% to 1.14% after all retail fees in the month of April. To put that in context, the floating rate index did 0.48%. Fixed rate composite bond index fell an enormous 1.98%, and the Bloomberg Global Aggregate Benchmark Bond Index also declined by about 2% in the month. Finally, equities were also hammered. Our next best performing fund was our A-plus rated daily liquidity floating rate long short opportunities fund, which returned 1.12% in the month of April after all retail fees. This was followed by the A-plus rated daily liquidity floating rate long short credit fund, specifically the New Zealand dollar unit class, which returned 1.10%, and the US dollar unit class, which returned 1.07% after retail fees. Our daily liquidity full capital structure floating rate ETF called HBID, which we run for beta shares, returned about 0.9% net of fees, inclusive of franking in the month of April. And then our cash in hand strategies, or RBA cash plus 1% and RBA cash plus 1.5% strategies, known as the Smarter Money Fund and the Short Term Income Fund, turned about 0.6% net of fees in the month. Our one long duration strategy in Australia, the fixed rate, A plus rated daily liquidity active composite bond fund, which trades under the ticker FIXD. So it's also an ETF that beat the composite bond index, which is its benchmark by about 50 basis points in the month of April. So in the wash up, what does that mean about 12 month returns? Well, our A plus rated floating rate long short credit fund after retail fees has returned 12.2 to 12.3% over the year to April. The US dollar version of that strategy has returned 14.2% after fees. The New Zealand dollar unit class has returned 14.6% after fees. Coming a close second behind our long short credit fund, our long short opportunities funds returned about 12.0% net of fees. Coming in close, second behind the long short credit fund has been our floating rate high yield fund and our long short opportunities fund, which both returned in Aussie dollars about 11.6% to 11.96% after fees. Next comes our short term income fund in US dollars, which returned 7.43% net of fees over the last year. In New Zealand dollars, it's actually done even better at 8.12% after fees. In Aussie dollars, it's done just shy of 7% at around 6.7 to 6.8% net of fees. Smarter Money Fund has done 6.6 to 6.7% net of fees. HBID has returned about 7.3% net of fees. Active Composite Bond Fund, which is one of the leading long duration strategies in Australia, the trades under the ticker FIXD, has done about 4.4% above the Composite Bond Index, which is its benchmark. Now, remember, past performance is no guide to future returns. Please read carefully the product PDSs to better understand the risks. Please consult your financial advisor to get more information on these strategies. And we look forward to speaking to you next week.
This podcast does not provide financial advice. It is not an invitation to invest in any financial product, and the information in it should not be relied on for any decisions. All views expressed represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or a recommendation and should not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit the moneysmart.gov.au website to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.